You're listening to the Bigfoot Information Project podcast, episode 5, Bigfoot in the Big Thicket. As someone who had never been there before, I admit my image of Texas was formed mostly by TV shows and old westerns. Dry, dusty plains dotted with tumbleweeds, oil wells, and the occasional stretch caddy with longhorns stuck to the grill. While that might describe some parts of the state, I found while visiting there last summer that it does not describe the eastern third. Well, except for the oil wells. And you know, the Cadillacs, but anyway. Roughly speaking, everything east of a north-south line drawn through the middle of Dallas gets over 40 inches of rainfall each year. Towering loblolly pines and leafy oaks cover the countryside, and at least 5 large rivers flow south on their way to the Gulf of Mexico. It's also the part of the state with the overwhelming majority of reported Sasquatch activity. In the southeast corner of the state, not far from the Louisiana border, is a remarkable place called the Big Thicket National Preserve. Established in 1974 and located just north of Beaumont and 100 miles or so northeast of Houston, the Big Thicket is just under 100,000 of the most biodiverse acres found anywhere in the world. Home to more than 100 species of trees and shrubs and over 5,000 flowering plants, it also contains hundreds of animal species, including wild hogs, venomous snakes, pileated woodpeckers, and alligators. 10,000 years ago, you would have found mastodons, giant sloths, and tapirs being snacked upon by saber-toothed tigers here. To tell you the truth, after spending just 2 days there with members of the Texas Bigfoot Research Conservancy, I wouldn't have been too surprised to see them there still. I was in the thicket to observe work in an ongoing TBRC project called Operation Forest Vigil. By placing camera traps well away from human activity, it's hoped that compelling photographic evidence of Bigfoot can be captured. As the most rugged wilderness area in the part of the state with the most reported Sasquatch sightings, the team I'm with from the TBRC hope the thicket will someday produce images of high enough quality to spur serious interest in the animal. The leader of our group on this trip is Daryl Coyer, whose experience as Air Force intelligence is betrayed by the military precision with which he briefs us on the day's objectives. My previous trips into the woods with people looking for hairy bipedal animals have been a bit more laid back, to put it mildly. It's obvious that in Texas, they take their Bigfootin' pretty seriously. According to Daryl, we are to find and service over a dozen camera traps. We'll be packing a laptop computer with us to download any images found, and we'll each carry a load of fresh batteries to replace those already in the cameras. Since we're making this trek near the beginning of July, it's hot and humid, so we'll each need to carry a lot of water. The traps are far apart and dispersed over an area of several square miles. There are no trails, other than the occasional meandering game path. It would appear as though I am in for more than a leisurely nature hike. We pile into the trucks and head out to the thicket. Following the advice of handheld GPS units, we stop at the side of a road cut into the woods and dive into the undergrowth. With nothing more than the invisible signals of the satellites overhead to guide us, we eventually arrive at the location of the first camera. As they begin the ritual I'll see repeated many more times in the coming days, I ask Daryl and fellow TBRC member Ken Helmer to describe their work.
My name's Daryl Coyer. I'm with the Texas Bigfoot Research Conservancy. And I'm out here with a team of investigators and scientists, and we are performing maintenance on an array of cameras that we have out in this area. And this, we consider this to be one of the best areas in the state of Texas in terms of reported sightings. So we feel like that there is a biological entity behind all this. So what better way to try to get evidence of that biological entity? What better way than cameras? So we've got all these cameras put out here, and that's what we're doing now. We're coming out here, we're gonna check the cameras for battery power. We're gonna check the flash cards, the memory cards, see what sort of images we have, if any. The last one was a bit of a disappointment. We only had 2 images on it, but.
This is the camera you've designated as number 12, is that correct?
Camera Y12.
Y12.
The area, we call the area Y. And this camera is number 12.
You have a total of 13 cameras in this area.
13 in this particular area, that's right. And they sort of form a little smiley face across this area, sort of like a sort of a picket line of cameras.
So I'm going to describe this. You've got a tree here. You've got it's like a steel case around this camera, and it's held to the tree with some pretty significant looking chains and a pretty heavy lock. You have the lock wrapped in camo duct tape. Why do you wrap the lock up like that?
That's just to make it less visually conspicuous.
The lock is bright yellow, and right. You wrap it up, you can't even see it anymore.
Yeah, and I've heard all the theories and debates about how, the Sasquatch can sense all this. We don't believe any of that. We don't. We're going at this strictly from a scientific basis, that it's an animal and that it has no extra sensory perception, no sort of superpowers. It may have a keen sense of sight, as most primates do. It may have a keen sense of hearing and smell. And so we're just proceeding based on those premises. And so we try to make these things as visually inconspicuous as possible. And so we have the steel box, which is camouflaged. We have subdued coloring on the chain and the strap that goes around, and then we use the camo duct tape to cover up the yellow padlock, and that's it. It's pretty hard to find, actually. Even if we know where they are on our GPSs, it takes a little effort just to find them. So
now, this camera, the last time someone's been here, how long has it been out here between battery changes and things?
I think it's right at 70 days for this particular camera, so we're anxious to see if it got any images at all, and that's what Dr. Palmer is checking on here.
So what do you see on the camera? What's the status?
Well, we showed up and our battery said battery failed, which means that if you use the pod's juice, there's actually a little bit of energy saved in it so you can manipulate it. And this camera, we have three images. So I'm going to take the compact flash out here and we're going to go look on the computer.
Is there an average number you usually find? I mean, sometimes you see none, sometimes you see a lot more than three?
Well, it's different. It just depends on what types of animals come through. We set the cameras up a little higher so we don't catch a lot of smaller animals like coons and coyotes, things like that. But sometimes a camera will show nothing for a while, and then another season it might show 10 or 15. We've had up to 20 pictures sometimes. The other cameras we have in this unit, in 2.5 weeks, each of them had about 6 to 10 pictures and videos on them. Okay. So we'll see.
Okay. So this camera's about 4 feet off the ground, it looks to me.
Yeah.
Maybe a little higher than that. Alton's going to measure it.
Let's just say 54.
So obviously our goal is to take an image of a tall, upright animal, so not a hog or a deer. So we probably miss a lot. That would be true, but if a Sasquatch does walk in front of the camera, I don't think we want a picture of his legs, so we kind of aim the camera straight out. But usually we can detect things as long as they walk in front of the infrared.
On the way in, you guys were saying that you wouldn't mind getting a picture of a black bear. Why is that?
Well, there's black bears are not supposed to be in Texas anymore. They've been hunted out. I'm not sure when the last recorded black bear was in here. I kind of remember that here in the 80s. Well, we did find in the thicket research unit that someone had recorded one in 1988 here. But that would be interesting as well. Red wolves are supposed to be extinct from this area, so it'd be interesting to find that. It's a possibility of jaguars, I guess, because that is their original territory, but they're supposed to have been gone too. But there's the occasional sighting of a black panther, which could be from a jaguar. But I don't think anybody really knows. There's never been a full detailed study of all the flora and fauna in the thicket. And I think people are still trying to do that. So there's still undiscovered things in here. Most of them are probably small.
So you guys are looking for something very specific, but there's a lot of other sort of ancillary things that could come out of this study.
That's right. That's right. And I think if we could find another rare or endangered species in here and document it, that perhaps that may serve to better protect the area, and therefore better protect, possible Sasquatch habitat.
Let's see what we got on here. You have the flashcard, Sawbones?
I got it.
How many images? You only said only three?
Three images.
Oh my gosh.
One of us and two Sasquatches.
That'll work. All we need is one, right?
That's right. I'd like to have more than one.
I'm still recording, so the moment you see the Bigfoot, I'm going to get your holy crap image.
This is camera
Y12. All nighttime.
Well, these are animals.
What is that, a deer?
That's a deer. Another deer.
Where is it?
Right here.
Oh, wow.
And this is Sasquatch.
Three deer.
Yeah. Yep, okay.
Three little deers.
Yep.
And that one's from 6/14, so there's a two month gap between the first picture and the last picture.
Yep.
So we were talking back at the last camera that one of the reasons you bring the computer into the field is so that you can see the images here and if you do have anything, conduct an investigation of the site if you see something interesting.
Yeah, we bring the laptop out just so we can do sort of a preliminary field analysis. We may need to take some sort of action, you know, based on what we find on the flashcards. We'd love to have one of those small card readers, but so far, I mean, the issue's money, you know. The nonprofit money doesn't come easy, so. But that's what we would love to have, but as it is now, we just decided to bring these laptops out here. And they, you know, they get the work done.
Sure. Walking along and I can hear thunder rumbling. It's getting kind of cloudy. Why does it always rain when I go hunting for Sasquatch?
Eventually, it does start to rain. And while the thought of that in the heat sounds nice, the reality is the stillness of the air down amongst the undergrowth only makes it impossibly more humid than it was before. In fact, I'm now of the opinion that we need more than just the word humid to describe exactly how cloyingly, oppressively, and smotheringly humid it actually is. And we're not even halfway through with our first day's work. After hours of some of the most physically demanding activity I've ever had the pleasure of enduring, we begin the hike back to the trucks. We're all soaking wet, hot, tired, and uninterested in small talk. Finally, I get my chance to imitate Les Stroud from Survivor Man.
At the end of day one, I found myself back muscles that were seizing up and finding it harder and harder to place my feet where they needed to be. It's becoming lethargic. Hard to concentrate. These are all classic signs of dehydration. The big thicket of Texas is not a place to be entered into lightly in late June, early July. You gotta bring lots of water. Lots of water. You gotta bring food. You gotta keep yourself hydrated and energized. Oh, you're gonna have a hard time getting back out.
As the day ends, we're back at our base, a refreshingly air-conditioned structure with showers, a full kitchen, beds, and an abundance of cushy chairs to collapse in. No, we're hardly roughing it, but the thought of trying to sleep in the liquid atmosphere outside, on the ground, in a tent, is not an appealing one. And of course, that's not even factoring in what makes up the bulk of biomass found in the thicket. Insects. At night, it seems as though there's nothing else out there but bugs. Chris Buttonbaugh is a member of the TBRC board and its resident photographer. As project leader of Operation Forest Vigil, he's in charge of the overall management and logistical operation of the project. Unfortunately, due to professional obligations, he was unable to attend our trip into the thicket. However, he and I were able to sit down at the home of Craig Woolheater and discuss the operation along with the reasoning behind it.
Can you describe your role in the camera trap operation?
Oh, yes. I'm actually the project leader. Basically, just help pick the equipment and work with the other guys to distinguish where the best places when we're out in the field to place the cameras, and I just make sure that they keep detailed charts on camera placement and you know, any kind of height, and just in case we do catch the picture we're looking for, we'll actually have all the extra data to know about height and placement and distance of the hopefully captured picture we're looking for, to go back and do measurements.
How do you select the locations that you place the cameras in, both generally and then specifically in the field?
The main areas are picked for a long history of sightings and activity, from past reports of hunters, just reports we've got over the years. And then as far as the actual cameras, as we place them out in the field, it has to be sort of a wide area so the picture can actually not be too much vegetation, let's say, in front of it that would actually trigger it.
So the if it gets too much sunlight, that will trick the camera into thinking that there's something in front of it when there's not.
Right. If there's too much sunlight, actually the heat will set the motion sensor off, because they are heat sensitive. And we've of course had cameras where the heat is totally heated up, let's say, grass in front of the camera and just triggered it every 2 or 3 minutes.
So it isn't, these aren't motion sensing cameras, they're more heat sensing cameras. Is
actually that correct? They're both. They're motion and heat.
Okay. So just a bow waving should not set it off unless it's warmer than it.
Yeah, it's normally in the 90s to the 100s will really affect. In the summertime, we actually have quite a few pictures taken. Okay. If the sun comes in at a high angle or through the vegetation, okay, it will actually, it can really mess up, you know, your placement of the camera. But that's why I try to keep extremely large, at least 2 gigabyte cards in each camera. So while they're out in the field at least 3 months, if it does take 10 or 100 pictures, I still have plenty of room on the cards for us to be able to, you know, have just extra space there.
So relatively speaking, most people, if you're thinking about the sort of consumer digital cameras that most people have, how would the pictures coming out of these traps compare to that sort of thing?
Actually, a lot of the consumer cameras would be very similar $200 to $300 range cameras, which actually a lot of people do make game cameras out of $200 to $300 digital cameras. There's actually a whole, let's say, technical group in the game camera field, and they're called homebrewers. Oh. And they actually take off-the-shelf Olympus cameras and Sonys, and you can buy kits and actually make your own game cameras. So the commercially made cameras are very similar to that. Sometimes, actually, the off-the-shelf cameras have better optics, sure, than the commercially bought cameras, because the ones that are commercially bought are really just for hunters to capture pictures of deers and stuff for hunting season. They're not always, you're going to be your best.
Right, a lot of people just use these to make sure there's something to shoot later on in the area that they put it in.
They may have a hunting lease and they just want to, you know, see what kind of deer they're going to be able to bag, I guess, later in the season.
The cameras that are out there now, some of them have different capabilities than others. What's the best camera out there? What can it do that the other ones can't do?
The best cameras we use actually have video capability and still capability. So they're going to capture a still picture at the first part of the event, and each picture is an event. So you have the picture at the beginning of the event, and then you have, I set the cameras to record 1 minute of video. You could actually break that down into just like 10-second increments and just have a 10-second clip, but I just prefer to have it record the longest possible event as, you know, just in case we capture that very important moment. I mean, I'd like it to record 3 or 4 minutes, but the cameras we use are not capable of doing that.
Currently, there's 13 cameras in the field. Do you have plans to increase that number? And if so, by when? When do you think you would do that?
One area has close to 13. Actually, we have, right, there's two main areas, and there's at least 2 dozen cameras in those combined areas, and the goal is to at least reach 100 cameras. To reach that is not very easy, you know, where we are right now, it's just not a very easy goal right now. So we at least 25 to 40 to 50 and then hopefully 75. I mean, it may take a few years to get there. But the more cameras you have in the field, to me, they're more eyes.
Yeah.
And they're working 24/7 for you, 365 days a year. And the great thing about digital, which has only been around for a few years, is they have the ability to record so many images. And like in just a few years ago, we just had 35 millimeter cameras, so it'd eat up 36 pictures. And, you know, it maybe take you a few weeks to a month to get out there, and every picture was eaten up by a little herd of deer.
Right.
And you had to get them developed, so you don't know what you have until you get back.
And right. And the way that we do it in the field is I'll actually take my computer in the field and we'll check the cameras right there on the spot. So if we find out a camera is actually maybe not performing the way we want it to, we'll either adjust it for a different angle or we'll totally move it just to a different area and where the cameras are in the main area.
The operation this weekend, if again, there's only in this particular area 13 cameras. If you get into 25, 50, 75 cameras, you're going to need a lot of people to do that in a reasonable amount of time to go out there and service those cameras.
Definitely. Right now, we'll usually take about 10 people, and depending on our schedule, if we can at least get 2 to 3 days in the field, we can check half the cameras one day because it's at least an 8 to 10 hour hike, and it's very warm and wet. And they're just very hard areas to get to each camera. Mm-hmm. And then by the second day, we'll check the other cameras. Or if we can even better have two teams and do it all in one day. But we just don't, because of funding, we don't always have a way of checking every camera having two computers in the field.
Right.
Hopefully after our conference and we're able to raise some funds this year, I hope to actually be able to purchase a hard drive that I can actually offload the cards into that has a large 4-inch viewer.
Yeah,
so we don't have to carry $3,000 laptops into the field.
Yeah, you save a lot of weight and save a lot of effort, and yeah, that's just a lot more convenient, I would think.
Right, because I'm carrying a 15-inch laptop and a Pelican waterproof case, and you know, you're tacking an extra 20-25 pounds on your
right.
back, not including all your snacks and your food and your water that you need and tools.
You need a lot of water out there. You need a lot of water.
At least a gallon or more per person per day.
Can you talk about what you do to protect the cameras from the elements and from the other critters that are out there that for some reason like to eat your cameras?
Well, unfortunately, you know, you learn from your mistakes, and one of the areas is quite frequented by black bears. And we've actually lost 2 cameras from bears. So after that, I've actually had to go in and custom make a case out of steel caging. Was the first one that I did with another member, and it's worked so well. I was able to find a gentleman who can actually make steel boxes for us. And so I've been able to have those custom made for our cameras. And then I incorporate a very heavy gauge chain and ratchet straps. The ratchet straps hold the camera taut to the tree, and then the chain's there for security from if a hunter was to come by to keep him
right.
from stealing it.
Right.
And if the bear was able to at least break the straps, he's not going to break through the chain.
I guess that's one of the reasons why humans would want to mess with these is if they were in there hunting and they shouldn't be, and they suddenly realize that there's a game cam sitting over there, that's probably going to annoy them.
Right, and also it's probably going to photograph them coming in.
Right.
And the areas we have the cameras are anywhere from private land to protected land. So if anybody's hunting in this area and they're caught, they already know that they've caught doing an illegal activity.
Mm-hmm.
And they definitely don't want the camera catching them, so they're looking at the best way to get this camera and not be documented.
Sure.
How did where was the genesis of this project? Whose idea was it? How did it come into being?
I don't know if I'd just say it was my own idea. I mean, I would say it's a collaborative effort of many of the members in the group. I've studied over the years other successful wildlife projects searching for, you know, hidden animals in Sumatra, the Amazon, and studying National Geographic stuff over the years, just been an avid reader and, you know, watching their television shows. I was introduced to a gentleman in the 90s named Michael Nichols, who's a photographer who started using camera traps for National Geographic. And I thought, wow, this would be great for the kind of research we do. But the systems they use are with actual starting, they were professional 35 millimeter cameras, and then they moved into digital these past couple of years. But those cameras are like, you know, you're talking $1,500 per trap, but the quality is just, you know, it's magazine quality.
Do those have a like a physical trigger, or are they using the same kind of technology that your cameras are using?
They actually use a system made by a company called Trailmaster, and it's a small box with a heat sensor or a motion sensor. You have different models you can buy, and they're usually about $500 and go up to over $1,000. And it's a box, and you can basically station it anywhere on a tree or low to the ground, and there's a cable that comes from that to wherever you want the camera. And then it will trigger the camera, and then you can actually have multiple flashes like you'd have in a studio set up to illuminate the area view of the animal coming into you know, where your trap is set up.
So the by looking at other successful programs similar to yours, that's sort of where the genesis was. How did it sort of come into being? How did it come into be an actual operation in the field?
It was I was talking to a member, I guess it was a couple years ago, and he actually kind of introduced me to these commercial game cameras, and after one of our conferences, because we were able to raise funds, and he told me how fast the trigger speed was on these, because I just thought, wow, digital, that would be the way to go, because we had used 35 millimeter cameras on weekend operations for 2 and 3 days, and they just never really produced anything that, you know, we were hoping for. And it would eat up all your film, and or, you know, you'd have to wait and come back a month later. So I said, well, why don't we go ahead and buy a couple of these cameras and try them out. And literally the first camera that was set out, we caught two really clear, crisp images of a coyote. And I said, these are going to be, you know, really great for doing for a big project if we can find a good area. And private property has been so hard for us to find where the landowner didn't have, hopefully, anybody trespassing, you know, so we know the cameras would be safe. But we actually were able to track down one area, put the first batch of cameras out, and then we were able to, through basically members by donations, we were able to buy a couple more cameras. It just started from there, and now we had three areas. We lost one area because of sale of property. And now we have two main areas that have done really well for us. I mean, we've documented every, kind of wildlife that's pretty much there in these areas, you know, except for the main wildlife we're trying to document, you know, of course, the Sasquatch.
If you do this, I mean, because this has been running for several months now.
It's just been over a year.
Okay. If you find yourself a year from now not having gotten the picture you want, do you think that you'll basically continue with the same tactics you're using, or might you try some other tactics, and have you thought about what those might be?
Well, you definitely have to look at, you know, maybe what we could be doing wrong. I mean, we're always learning from every time we go out in the field and check these cameras. We have ongoing maintenance of the cameras, and it could just take adjusting a camera on a tree to a different angle to actually needing to move it completely. If we're in the same boat in a year, and we just have to, you know, we'll have to see if any more sightings have come out of that area and see if it's still worth keeping the cameras there. It's just such a small amount of cameras for such a large area.
Yeah.
Even if one of these creatures frequent in the area, you know, doesn't mean it's always going to run in front of your camera. But I do believe that it's a physical animal that can be captured, so this is the best we can do at this point, you know, with the funding we have, which is very limited.
What's the biggest, most expensive thing you've lost in the field that you just eats you up still to this day that it's gone and broken, because this is not, I mean, this is out in the field, man. Nobody sees these things for months. You lose a lot of stuff out there, I'm guessing, or you have lost several things.
Well, I was real disappointed to actually lose a brand new video rig that we had bought, plus the video camera inside. It was definitely over $1,000 to $1,300 worth of equipment. That really hurt, because that was our main video rig, and to lose that through a bear. I mean, a bear literally climbed up on this thing and popped it open, and I think he bit into the camera, it looks like, and then the camera laid out, and it was pretty much destroyed.
Why do you think the bears are so fascinated with these things?
I think that they're actually attracted to the plastic. Something about the petroleum and the plastic, definitely when it's out in the middle of the woods, it's to a bear who has a very sensitive nose, it's just very unnatural object that's curious about it. So it's going to go in and love to chew on it and check it out. And it probably, of course, you know, it could have human scent on it. I mean, we try to de-scent everything if possible, but it doesn't mean you're getting all the scent off.
By the second day, I've learned something about following Daryl around in the bush. Basically, don't do it. This moment of inspiration struck me as I was entangled in a thorn bush Daryl had plowed through moments before. As I cursed and picked little pointy barbs out of my skin and clothing, I noticed the others in our group had gone around the clump of foliage that Daryl had chosen to go over. Lesson learned. At midday, we stopped at a small clearing of dwarf palmettos to enjoy some genuine government-issued cuisine. The sky is clouding over and thunder rumbles nearby as Daryl and Ken share their thoughts regarding the operation and what drives them personally to participate.
We've serviced 10 cameras now, and we've pulled out a bunch of pictures, but they're mostly, in fact, they're all pictures of nothing or animals or us. Do you ever, after all the work getting in here and the expense and everything else, how do you not get discouraged by that? How do you just keep going and keep coming back here time and again?
Well, I think it's because we all realize that field biology is not an easy thing, and that it requires a lot of hard work and sweat, blood. You know, trying to photograph general wildlife is very difficult, and so when you put on top of that you're trying to photograph what we think is something that's very rare and endangered, then it just compounds the difficulty. And so we all realize that, and we realize that this is at least a multi-year task that we have here. And so we're prepared to do this and to come out as often as we need to do it, you know, for years if it takes that. So I think that's our mindset as an organization.
Is this pretty much an open-ended operation, or do you guys have a date in mind that you're going to stop? I mean, do you have a time frame that you're working against?
Well, we've proposed 5 years, but you know, I think we're all prepared to continue. And I know that people would ask, well, at what point do you just sort of give up and realize that there's nothing out there? At no point, especially for those of us who've had experiences, who've had encounters, at no point will we give up because we don't have a photograph of one. So it takes years to photograph a rare animals. And so, you know, again, we don't have a timetable. We sort of attached a 5-year mission to this, but it may take 10 years. We may do it for 12 years. Who knows? We're just prepared to stay the long haul.
I think I have a different take too on what keeps you from getting discouraged. And for me, it's a more rational answer. And that is, these things or any animal can walk just to the other side of the tree and you don't get a picture, or it can be completely on the other side of the park. So you really need a lot more cameras, a lot more, long-term surveillance. So just because we're not finding anything doesn't mean there's nothing here. We see animal signs all over, yet we only get pictures of a few deer and hogs, a coyote, and now a vulture.
That's the thing. You've got maybe, I don't know, I've added them up, maybe 100 pictures so far, and there's signs of the hogs all over the place, and you've got maybe half a dozen pictures of hogs, and these things have been out here for several months.
And as well, you know, we're not aiming the picture at the ground, looking for raccoons, possums, squirrels, you know, mice, anything else that might trigger it. So these things are up in the air, and so something rather large has to set it off. So I'm sure there's much more animals we've missed that have actually walked under that beam of the motion detector.
Each of these cameras is costing, I don't know, I think you're telling me something like $400 to $600 somewhere in there, and there's 13 of them. How does the TBRC fund this? This is, as far as I know, one of the most expensive operations that any organization of your kind is doing right now. How do you pull that off?
Well, actually, we have right at 24 cameras deployed, and we've split those cameras up between two areas. So, you know, like we said, each camera unit probably is at least $500, and that counts. You know, that's including the cameras, any chains, any sort of security boxes that we use,
flash cards,
batteries. So we're talking at least $500 per unit, and then we have the added expense of just the trips into these very remote places in Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas, and just a whole lot of expenses that the list is too long to really go over here. But I think we've calculated and estimated that we've probably put into this by now probably between $30,000 and $40,000 into this camera project, and it's only going to get bigger because our goal is to acquire more cameras and deploy more cameras and to make more trip, and this is an ongoing project. And the way we fund this is the TBRC has we have membership dues, which you know, I mean, you can calculate it in your head. If you have 50 or 60 or 70 members and they each pay you $60 a year, well, that's, you know, that's $4,000 or $5,000 right there, and then also just through donations. And we also have the Texas Bigfoot Conference, which is an annual conference, and we raise money through that as well. And so, as a nonprofit, everything that the Texas Bigfoot Research Conservancy makes in terms of money, in terms of funds, has to go exactly back into our mission statement, which is to find and document a rare, elusive primate that we believe exists in this four-state region.
The Forest Service knows you're here. What's your relationship with the Forest Service? How does that work, or not work, as the case may be?
They know of our project. I wouldn't say it's an ordeal, but it's not easy. I mean, we have to draw up a proposal, and we have to submit the proposal, and then they have a meeting over it, and then they discuss the merits of how it might benefit the land that they're managing, and then they've approved everything so far, so we have no reason to suspect that they won't in the future. But we do have to go through. It's just a hoop we have to jump through.
If you guys are successful out here, if you get a good picture, I'm guessing that a group of your size and your organization, you've come up with some sort of protocol of what happens at that point. Can you describe what it is that you guys will do when you finally get that picture that you're looking for?
In general terms, what we'll do is we're going to work through governmental agencies like Texas Parks and Wildlife and other agencies with whom we're presently working. You know, we'll write up the proper proposal, the papers, and we'll have those submitted. If we have photographs, then we'll submit those to the proper people that are in Texas Parks and Wildlife and other agencies, and then we'll go from there.
Well, I would add that the goal isn't to post it on the internet and be on TV and on Jay Leno next week. It's to privately get this funded through the proper agencies, whether it's Texas Parks and Wildlife or other governmental agencies, to get funding, likely through grant submissions, so that we can obtain more evidence, essentially, more photographs, more video if we can. Obviously, once it's designated as a true species, then you know it'll be important to understand not only that it exists, but how it exists and it's, you know, what its habitat is and what does it eat, how does it survive, how many are there. So you really have to do a long-term study, similar, I would think, to the ivory-billed woodpecker. The only way to do that is obviously through lots of money, probably millions of dollars of money. The only way to get that type of money is to have proof that this thing exists. So that's why I think this Operation Forest Vigil is important, because the goal is to obtain photographic or video evidence. The goal of this project is not to go out and find footprints and whatever else people think is evidence of Sasquatch existence.
Now, what's interesting about that is that, you know, we have a motion picture taken 40 years ago. We've got lots of, well, not lots, but we've got photographs. What I see in your organization, because you're upfront with the authorities, because you have what I think of as pretty good relationships with some of the larger institutions, it seems like you're building up equity in your relationship with these people, so that when it happens, you have some not authority, but you have you know, they have respect for you.
Yeah, I think a large part of it will come down to the credibility of the individuals or the organization involved, and I think we're building on that. I think if we were to submit to the governmental authorities with whom we're already working, if we were to submit to them tomorrow a 1-minute video of a Sasquatch walking by, and you know, it turns and stops and looks at the camera and walks off, I think they're going to take it very seriously. I'm not saying that they'll necessarily list the species, although we've had hints that that would happen, but they, I think they'll take it very, very seriously. And as Dr. Helmer alluded to, I think we may be able to more easily gain access to grants.
Absolutely, I agree. But again, it'd have to be clear evidence,
yeah.
Not brown clear form brown. In a bush
right.
that
right.
set the camera off. I mean, this thing would have to be very close to the cameras, and that's the hard part, as I mentioned earlier. So it's all random, and it's all luck. We don't know the habits of this thing, so we don't know where to put the cameras. So it's all random placement in areas that we think have high animal activity, and then we just have to wait and see.
What are you looking for when you place the cameras?
Well, we're just looking for, first thing that we like to have is we like to have an area where there have been reported sightings. And so usually where there's a concentration of reported sightings. And then on top of that, areas where we have found what we interpret as sign of this species as well. When we put that together, then that's where we decide to place the cameras. And so we think we're in a good area. We think both areas that where we now have cameras deployed, we think they're the best areas or among the best areas in this 4-state region. So I can't see us abandoning these particular areas, but I can see us perhaps moving cameras within each area. And how we identify spots is just that we look for, you know, wildlife trails, sign. And if we find what we interpret as Sasquatch tracks, I mean, that would be a great place to have a camera. But that's generally how we do it. I mean, we look for a lot of animal signs, and that's where we place the cameras.
Up to this point, have you had any images that are even fishy or interesting to look at, or has it pretty much all been deers and hogs and birds and stuff?
Well, we it's been pretty much just your standard wildlife. We had one interesting photo, but it's very vague, and it's internet fodder, and it just leads us to, you can speculate all day about what it is, but that doesn't do us any good.
You guys need to get one of those guys that can draw the red lines. You probably don't have any of those.
No, we don't have anybody like that.
Another thing that strikes me about this is we spent how many hours yesterday were we out?
We were out about 10 hours yesterday.
And we walked into the woods. I'm going to guess that was a... Was that like 4 miles in, something like that? Was it that far?
I think it was probably 3 at the farthest point. Yeah.
So total about 6 miles total, and we're not walking on forest trails or anything. We're like plowing through
grazing trails.
Yeah.
You have to follow either animal trails, but they're random, and most of the animals are low to the ground, so there's lots of overbrush, and they just scatter, and part of the problem is. Well, there's several things. One, the terrain changes every quarter mile or so. One moment you'll be walking through thick loblolly pines with the trees very close together. And the underbrush is thinner, but, you know, it's hard to get your packs through. Right. The next minute you're going through thicket where you have to walk over the bush. The next time you're in hardwood bottoms that are easier to walk, but with high grasses that you have to high step. Thorns. There's thorns, there's mud, there's snakes, there's... holes everywhere, wherever a tree had rotted.
There's banana spiders.
All of a sudden there's a big hole and it's covered with huge leaves, and then you step in it and you can break an ankle. I fell in 2 of those yesterday. We have large packs on that have to get through the things. There's gargantuan spiders, banana spiders out here. And so we just have to go from point A to point B to each camera. And the way you do that is with a combination of our GPS and our compass. Well, our compass isn't going to take us to the exact point. Our GPS will, but the GPS doesn't work all the time in here. And so you have to use a combination of both. In some areas where you're very thick cover, the GPS doesn't work, but you know you have to go east, so you keep going east. And then when you get a clearing, you get a GPS reading, it tells you you need to go left, you go left, and you follow the compass direction. So you just sort of zigzag your way to the spot. And then once we get there, then you have to look for your cameras, which sometimes are even hard to find, even though we know they're at.
You think you'd be able to do this without GPS?
Absolutely not. No. No way.
You'd never see the cameras again.
Impossible. Never. Impossible.
There was a camera earlier. You walked right by it. We got a good video of you walking right by the camera and turning around before you saw it again. So these things are really hard to spot sometimes.
That's right. If there's a Sasquatch in one of these, it's real. Nobody's walking 4 miles into the woods.
There's no human sign out here at all.
I mean, you know, with a gorilla suit on or whatever. I mean, we can't even do it with normal clothes. Yeah. It's very difficult without lots of water and food and, you know, so it'd be impossible to hoax one of these, you know, in my opinion, unless it's one of
maybe,
us.
Maybe not impossible, but very, very close to being impossible.
Well, that's one thing that strikes me about this place. I mean, I've been in woods before, but there's always, you'll see some sign of humans, and you don't really see any sign of humans in this place. I think I've seen one thing that reminds me that people have been here at some point.
Yeah, we're in what's referred to as the primitive big thicket in southeast Texas. The primitive big thicket encompasses about 1 million acres of mixed forest, pines, hardwoods, and it they call it the big thicket for a reason. I mean, it is truly, truly a thicket. In fact, now I think we talked last night, I think now it'd probably be proper to refer to it as the Great Thicket, because after Hurricane Rita, now you've got all these really old hardwoods that have been knocked over that provide these natural barriers that are just, they're really tough to navigate around and through. I mean, it's just, it really makes it difficult.
Yeah, that's one reason, you know, you couldn't walk through this place without a GPS and a compass, because every 50 to 100 yards, or feet rather, there's a deadfall. Yeah. So you have to go around it. And then as soon as you go around it, you're turned around and you've lost your direction. And so I remember when I first came out here, I went into the woods without a GPS or compass, because I knew by the map where a creek was running, and I knew it was only 100 yards away. So I said, well, if I just go that way, I'll hit it. And so I went in, and about 20 minutes later, I ended up at a fence in the middle of the thing. And I said, why is there a big fence here in a clearing? And I'd done a big half circle and was back on the pipeline with the guys about 150 yards down the road looking for me. And if I hadn't made it back, I probably would have gotten lost, I imagine.
The primitive big thicket actually encompasses, the western extremity of the primitive big thicket is the western border or the western range of the Sam Houston National Forest all the way over to the Louisiana state line. That's the primitive big thicket, and that's where we are. That, if you look at that on a map, if you look at, say, Interstate 45, and then run your finger all the way over to the Louisiana state line, that's area Y.
Yeah, I think another interesting thing about this place that most people don't know is the diversity of flora and fauna. This whole area of the Big Thicket actually is formed from a couple things. One is from just washout over eons from, you know, the Midwest. Rivers that used to run through here have laid out tons of soil, which has also brought plant seeds and other wildlife. But the last ice age, as the iceberg or the glaciers were advancing in temperature, the cold temperature was advancing south, several different diversity areas of flora and fauna got pushed into this area. And so within here you can see animals and plant life that are native to deserts as well as to the grasslands as well as to the piney woods, as well as swamps and prairies.
Alton was saying yesterday that he saw cattails growing up among ferns, and right, he had never seen that before. I can't say that I've ever seen that either. I've seen cattails and ferns, but never in the same spot.
Cattails with ferns with loblolly pines.
And there are roadrunners in here.
Magnolia trees. There's roadrunners in here.
Yeah.
There's actually...
And coyotes with the roadrunners.
Coyotes, right. Yeah. There's four of the five carnivorous plants in The United States are within the Big Thicket, and I think, if I remember right, every type of orchid in North America is also found here. But the interesting thing is, as you walk through here, the terrain changes and demarcates itself. Yeah. Actually, right now where we're sitting, as you can look around, you can see loblolly pines starting here, and there's this will be an island of pines. And if you go behind us, you see some oak. There's probably some magnolia trees. There's all sorts of hardwood. So we're on the edge of a hardwood forest and the pine forest. And then at the same time, as we look, this is hardwood, but a hardwood savanna, I guess, because there's prairie grass right here in front of us.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Yeah, it's something, isn't it? To your knowledge, is anyone now or has anyone done a study, an operation of this magnitude, that what you're doing right now?
Not that I know of. I don't know of anyone. Do you mean in this region or just mean anywhere? Not to my knowledge.
Yeah. I hear a lot of people talking about game cams, but they're up for a couple of days or whatever and they take them down. I mean, nothing like
that. Yeah, and there are some, I think some foolish beliefs that you put game cameras out and the Bigfoots disappear. The Bigfoots leave. That's crazy.
And I think another important thing to understand is a lot of people will come back and, well, there's all, hundreds of thousands of game cameras out. Why is there no picture? Well, most people put their game cameras on their land where they're at all the time, and there just may not be Sasquatches there. If you're on your land all the time, maybe one comes through there every now and then it's just the luck of whether you get the picture, but they may never be there. Maybe they're only there one or two days out of the year as they pass through. But these areas are national forests that are untouched by humans, essentially, at least nowadays. And they may harbor Sasquatches, and it is a big place. And like I mentioned earlier, we just have to get lucky. So, putting your own camera on your land 300 yards from your ranch house probably isn't going to be very successful, but lots of people like to think that.
Plus, I think that it's just now that technology is actually catching up.
That's right,
because I think up until very recently, game cameras have been notoriously slow to take photographs. So slow that once the object appears or walks in front of the field of vision of the camera, stands there for 5 seconds, walks off, then the camera would take a picture. I mean, we had our own game cameras that were just like that, and they were older. But now there are some companies like Cuddyback, which provides the mainstay of our camera force. There are some cameras that have really exceptionally fast trigger speeds, and half a second, which is pretty quick. And so we think that eventually is going to lead to this thing being photographed.
You guys have two pictures from that you've collected of what look like birds in flight.
That's right. One appears to be a vulture. The other one appears to be a hawk or an owl. The vulture we have actually as he's landing and you can see him just as he's hitting the ground. Then the video goes off and we got a minute video of the vulture walking around. And then the next picture is him flying away.
He had a very confused look on his face when he was walking around, I noticed.
Yes, he was. He was confused. And then the other one, I'm not certain exactly what type of animal it was, but you can clearly see it flying into the forest. And it's probably a hawk or an owl of some sort.
Well, it's starting to rain a little bit and lunch is over, so I just want to thank you guys for sitting down. I want to thank you a lot for having me along on this. It's been a great experience and I'm really glad I've been here.
Last thing I just want to say is how dangerous this is. Last time we came out here, Alton Higgins broke his ankle and I had to carry him out 7 miles.
Yeah, right.
I'm forever in your debt.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you. Oh, no, I'm cramped.
For the record, we found no images of Bigfoot on that trip, nor to my knowledge have they found any before or since. Unsurprising, I realize, since the math just isn't in their favor. The Big Thicket National Preserve covers 97,830 acres. Each camera, I'd estimate, covers a couple of thousand square feet at best. Break out your sixth grade math skills and you'll quickly realize Operation Forest Vigil is observing, statistically speaking, nothing. There could be a whole herd of Sasquatch thundering around southeast Texas, and the TBRC cameras might take years, decades even, to catch just one. But the other thing I've realized, and what was said to me in one way or another by nearly everyone I met on this trip, is that at least these people are trying. Instead of wringing their hands and bemoaning the lack of resources and interest devoted to this field, they have created a tightly knit organization with the devotion and discipline necessary to take matters into their own hands. No, in the greater scheme of things, they might not be doing much, but they are doing something that can only elevate legitimate interest in Sasquatch. They're advancing the cause of all those who take this subject seriously, and for that, they deserve our gratitude. I sincerely hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Bigfoot Information Project podcast. I appreciate the continued support of all the listeners out there and hope you'll stop by the Bigfoot forums at bigfootforums.com to leave feedback on this and all the Bibcast episodes. If you're like most people I've heard from and dislike waiting for new Bibcasts, then I might suggest you try out another podcast I'm involved with called The Bigfoot Show. It's a more informal, conversational, and hopefully entertaining look at the world of Bigfoot. You can find out more about it at thebigfootshow.com or subscribe via iTunes. Many thanks to the members of the TBRC for all their hospitality and kindness. Without it, this episode never would have happened. Visit their website at texasbigfoot.org, where you can read about Operation Forest Vigil and learn more about their organization. Until next time, this is Brian Brown, and I'll see you out there.
Buntenbaugh. Chris Buntenbaugh.
Perfect.
Chris Buntenbaugh.
Stop it. I said it right.
You say Buntenbaugh.
Buntenbaugh.
Pronounce the T.
Okay, stop it.